Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. As European leaders meet today in Brussels to deal with the unravelling euro crisis, we'll begin with an analysis of this 11th-hour effort from Clyde Prestowitz. A former councillor to the Secretary of Commerce, he feels that since the euro has been a godsend to Germany, it's past time for the Germans to either step up and save the euro or leave the euro. Then we will discuss the P5 plus one meeting with Iran in Baghdad with Nada Hashimi, a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the University of Denver and the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Future of Iran, with optimistic sounds coming out of the International Atomic Energy Agency about a possible breakthrough. We will look into why Iran has been prepared to endure crippling sanctions in order to hide a nuclear program they insist is only for peaceful purposes. Then finally, we'll examine what was behind the resignation of the head of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, who was often the lone dissenting voice in favour of increasing oversight, particularly in the wake of the Fukushima disaster. Arjan Makajani, the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, joins us to discuss how much Gregory Zasko's push for safety reforms made him a target for removal. Joining us now is Clyde Prestowitz, a former councillor to the Secretary of Commerce and the founder and president of the Economic Strategy Institute. He's the author of the best-selling books Trading Places, Asia After the Miracle, Rogue Nation, 3 Billion New Capitalists, The Great Shift of Wealth and Power to the East, and his latest, The Betrayal of American Prosperity, Free Market Delusions, America's Decline, and How We Must Compete in the Post-Dollar Era. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Van Rompuy's Chance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Clyde Prestowitz.
Oh, nice to be with you.
And Van Rompuy, of course, Herman Van Rompuy, the president of the European Council, they're meeting today. There's a summit in Brussels to deal with the ongoing euro crisis, which has been at least 2 years. They still haven't managed to get their hands around it. What explains the inability of the Europeans to build a sufficient firewall to stop this bleeding?
I think the fundamental problem is that there's not a sufficient European identity. These guys are all dealing with this as Germans and French and Greeks and Italians, and they've lost sight of what got it started in the first place, which was the dream and the vision of a united Europe. I think that this guy Van Rompuy, this is his moment. This is his chance to lift everybody's eyes, and because the issue here is not really the euro or the firewall or whatever it is. The issue here really is there going to be a Europe or not?
Well, this has, of course, enormous stakes for Europe, but it also has stakes over here in the presidential race, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, the president, obviously, at Camp David, like everybody else, has been pleading with Angela Merkel. She seems to hold his fate in her hands.
Europe is the world's biggest market. It's the biggest market for U.S. exports. It's going back into recession just at the moment when Obama needs economic growth for the election. No, he's begging Merkel to look a little higher and stop nickel and diming.
So do you think that is the heart of the problem in Germany, in as much as Merkel, of course, is looking over her shoulder at the German electorate? She's already lost a regional election to the Social Democrats, and it's a tough call, but basically it seems that it's up to her to educate the German people, who are feeling disdainful towards the people to the south. They think they're lazy and they don't pay taxes. The latter may be true, at least in the case of Greece. But the situation has somewhat become racialized, and nobody's talking about how the Germans have benefited from the euro and how it's been the German banks that have made these bad bets.
Precisely. All this stuff about all the Greeks don't pay taxes and the Spaniards are lazy, the Spanish budget, the Spanish government at the beginning of all this had less debt than the German government. What Spain got hit with was a real estate bubble funded by the German banks. And the Germans have been has not wanted to have to recapitalize their banks, and so they've imposed this eternal austerity on Spain and Southern Europe. And, you know, Merkel has been a masterful kind of parliamentary leader of, you know, putting together coalitions and kind of sensing which way the wind is blowing. But this is a moment that calls for a leader with a vision and a leader who can inspire and who can educate and who can change public opinion rather than just sensing public opinion. We haven't seen any of that kind of leader, and that's what we desperately need.
Again, I'm speaking with Clyde Pretzowitz, a former counselor to the Secretary of Commerce and the founder and president of the Economic Strategy Institute. His latest book is The Betrayal of American Prosperity, Free Market Delusions, America's Decline, and How We Must Compete in the Post-Dollar Era. Do you think the new French president, François Hollande, can somehow give Merkel some direction here? I mean, he's calling for euro bonds, and already the Germans have shot that down.
Yeah, I think Hollande is, I'm sympathetic with Hollande on this, but he's in a weak position. He's just newly elected. France is not as powerful as it used to be in the Franco-German partnership. He comes from the Socialist Party, which is, you know, seen as kind of leftist in Germany. I think he's in a weak position. What he has done has been to give some room. He's given some room for others like Mario Monti in Italy to voice alternative opinions. So he's gotten some discussion going, but the reason that I particularly identified Van Rompuy is because, you know, he's a guy without, you know, without a dog in the fight, really. This is not about what happens to Belgium. He is the guy who is the president of the European Council. So he's as close as you get to a real European leader. And this is a moment where I think a guy like that, who, you know, is respected and doesn't have a lot of enemies, can articulate a vision and try to move people and inspire people a bit to think bigger.
So what could he do to get them off the dime here? Because it seems to me that...
Well, I think two things. I think one thing is people, the Germans, have forgotten the cost of integrating Eastern Germany into Western Germany. And that was a cost that was high for the Germans, but it was also high for the rest of Europe. The rest of Europe paid to enable the unification of Germany. Germans have forgotten that. They should be reminded, because now is a moment for payback.
Well, isn't there a possibility, though, that this crisis could get worse fast? In other words, if there starts to be a run on the Greek euro and the Spanish euro, if people start to cash them in for German euros, for example, isn't that a real potential?
It is, absolutely. Now, my view is that the track that Europe is on right now is the track that is going to lead to the unwinding of the euro and possibly of the EU itself. It's a destructive track.
Well, then somebody over there has got to see the writing on the wall that you're talking about. It's obviously too late to create the equivalent of a Federal Reserve. I mean, if they had that, they probably would have been able to solve this problem long ago. Is it really all up to Merkel?
Well, I don't know that it's all up to Merkel, but it's really up to Germany. The Germans hold most of the cards here. you know, another alternative would be for, everybody's talking about the Greeks exiting the euro, another alternative would be for the Germans to exit the euro. In fact, that alternative, I think, makes more sense than the Greeks exiting the euro. Because the real problem here is that for the Germans, the euro is undervalued. And the rest of the European countries need a devaluation against Germany. So if the Germans stepped out and went back to the D-mark, then a new German D-mark would be a much stronger currency the rest of the Europe would have an automatic devaluation and become competitive and thereby get the stimulus that that they need for growth without the need for the Germans to make a direct transfer payment. So that's an alternative, but I think that's a very unlikely alternative. So you come back to, will the Germans wake up? Is there somebody in Germany who has a vision of Europe rather than a vision of Germany? Can they come up with a way of effectively creating some kind of a euro bond or a euro bank insurance system that commits all of the eurozone partners to guaranteeing the debt?
So, Clyde Prestwitz, again, former counsel to the Secretary of Commerce and the founder and president of the Economic Strategy Institute. So an economic solution would be for the Germans to pull out of the euro. But politically, that would be the death of the EU, right?
Well, I don't know that it would be. I mean, I can make an argument that, as I said, in terms of what Europe needs, a German revaluation, which could be achieved by the Germans dropping out of the euro and reinstalling the D-mark, that would, in fact, solve a lot of problems. I think that it's nobody has mentioned this idea except me. So I think it's not a likely idea.
Right.
And so I think it comes down to, is there... I keep thinking of Helmut Kohl. I keep thinking of the moment of German reunification. Helmut Kohl paid a huge price. You know, remember that the East German currency was integrated at par with the D-mark in reunification. Huge price they paid for reunification. But it was a vision. It wasn't an economic decision. It wasn't about dollars and cents. It was about rebuilding Germany. And they did it. Kohl did it. Had the support of Mitterrand and Bush and the other European leaders. And it's that kind of action, that kind of vision that's needed now.
Well, I understand that that the Social Democrats have been pushing for at least some wage increases in Germany.
Yes. Wage increases, yes.
So
that's positive, but it's small beer compared to what we're talking about.
Right. So again, it really, you can't just tinker with this situation, which is what they've been doing for
fast tinkering.
Right. Yeah. I mean, but unfortunately, it sounds from polling that I've read about German public opinion is that the German people are more ready than ever to say goodbye to the Greeks.
Well, they are, but this is where the question of leadership comes in. All I've heard from the German leaders, from Merkel, from Schäuble, from the other German leaders, all I've heard is this rat-a-tat repetition of the lazy Greeks, they don't pay their taxes, they retire too early, and so forth. I haven't heard anything from Europe, from German leaders talking about how it has been their ability to sell into these markets with an undervalued currency in the last 10 years that sparked their boom. I haven't heard any of them talking about how actually the Spanish government had less debt than the German government. I mean, this is a moment for leaders to step up to the plate and tell the truth and convince their own people.
And that hasn't happened yet. And as Merkel faces more election losses, the real question is she going to become more of a politician and less of a leader?
Well, yeah, that is the question. That is the question.
So
being a politician, she's losing. And so maybe she ought to think of trying a different game and try to be a leader.
Well, I imagine Obama tried to make that case as politely as possible.
Yeah, maybe he was too polite.
Uh-huh. So what's your sense then of You've given the prescription here for what needs to be done, and clearly, Clyde Prestowich, you're a little sceptical about whether any of these proposals are going to be implemented, and
yeah.
And you're pretty much putting all your cards on this obscure Belgium official who's now meeting with them.
Right.
So give us a realistic, what's your real...
I think it's the 11th hour. I think that... very strong possibility that the Greeks leave the euro. We don't know what the Greek elections are gonna turn out, but if you were betting on this, I'd have to say the probability is that the Greeks leave the euro. That there then comes enormous pressure on the Spaniards and the Portuguese. I don't honestly see if they can't stop this thing with Greece, the cost of stopping it for Spain and Portugal is going to be a lot higher. So I think that gets to be very difficult. So, I think that pessimism is justified, but there's still a chance.
Right.
I'm always have been a strong Europhile, and I don't want to give up till the last whistle blows here.
So, in terms of Spain, though, Clyde Prestowich, my understanding is that the Spanish banks are all but insolvent.
I think that's probably true. But it's not just the Spanish banks. These banks are all interlinked. And it's not clear how solvent the German banks are. It's a domino. It's a row of dominoes here. One goes down, and then it just increases the pressure on all the others.
So there really isn't. You don't think there's any way that the can can be kicked down the road until, say, after the elections. You think that something's going to snap before then?
It's impossible to predict. Maybe they can kick the can down the road until the elections, but maybe not. I just don't know.
Well, that's 6 months away, and
you're
saying it's a crisis. It's the 11th hour.
I think it's 11th hour. Right?
Yeah, so for the 12th hour to last for 6 months, that's asking a lot.
Yeah.
Well, is there any note that we can leave on apart from despair?
hope springs eternal. And you never know what people will do when they're faced with, who was it, Dr. Johnson, who said a sentence of death powerfully concentrates a man's mind?
Well, one would think...
You're talking about a sentence of death right now.
Right. I just haven't heard anybody, apart from yourself, in Europe, who's laid it out as clearly as it is, and I just wonder... who's going to be the truth teller over there to get their attention so that they do what has to be done?
That's the question.
Mm-hmm.
Van Rompuy, he's our man.
He's your man. We're back to Herman. All righty. Well,
I don't want to laugh at the guy. He is the president of the European Council. He's as close to Mr. Europe as they have. So this is a moment for him to step up.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Clyde Prestowich.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Clyde Prestowich, a former counselor to the Secretary of Commerce and the founder and president of the Economic Strategy Institute. He's the author of the best-selling books Trading Places, Asia After the Miracle, Rogue Nation, 3 Billion New Capitalists, The Great Shift of Wealth and Power to the East, and his latest, The Betrayal of American Prosperity, Free Market Delusions, America's Decline, and How We Must Compete in the Post-Dollar Era. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Van Rompuy's Chance. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about what looks like a breakthrough in the P5+1 talks with Iran.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound. Is all that makes the world go around. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
ای فدای اون همه عطرو بوی تو هر زمان دل می کشد پر به سوی تو هر کجا پا می نهم سر فرود آرم قبله گاه من شده خاک کوی تو.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nad Hashimi, who is a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and the co-editor of a new book, The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nad Hashimi.
Happy to be with you.
And the P5 plus one, a meeting in Baghdad with the Iranian delegations prior to it, the head of the IAEA, Mr. Amano, said that things look good. He'd had a meeting in Tehran. And apparently the six powers, that's the five permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany, have put forward a detailed proposal aimed at curbing Iran's nuclear program. Any news that you've heard from your contacts in Iran?
No. I mean, this is the first stage of substantive negotiations that really speak to core issues separating the West from Iran on the question of Iran's nuclear program. Press reports are indicating that both sides have brought proposals to the table that deal with many of the core outstanding and critical issues at the core of this conflict. And it remains to be seen whether there is room for common ground to resolve this issue. As you indicated, going into these talks in Baghdad, just yesterday, the head of the IAEA, Yukiya Amano, came forward and said that a tentative deal had been reached between Iran and the International Atomic Energy Association that would allow for very intrusive inspections of Iran's nuclear program, including some of those military sites that are suspected to be producing or testing nuclear weapons or technology that could lead to the production of nuclear weapons. So that seems to indicate that there's been a shift in policy and a possibility here that there could be some serious progress in resolving this issue.
Well, according to the Associated Press, an unnamed Iranian official said that the Iranian delegation have put forward a package of five items based on the principles of step-by-step and reciprocity. Now, we know that they want the sanctions to end and they don't want this new round of sanctions that starts in July to happen. I understand that was their first request, and I believe the P5 plus one said that's a non-starter.
That's correct. That's my understanding as well. I think the Iranians are going to, make demands, understandably, in the first round that I think we shouldn't expect are going to be accepted by the other side. It really, I think, is going to depend on whether there is room for compromise and sort of revisiting both proposals to find some common ground. I mean, what's interesting here, at least from my perspective, is, what seems to be a clear shift in willingness on the part of Iran to now negotiate and to consider a new policy that could perhaps meet the minimum demands that the West has been placing on Iran. And the big question will be whether there can be any common ground in a final sort of set of agreements where both sides can sort of come out of this looking like they have not caved in and that they both can claim victory to their own constituencies.
Again, I'm speaking with Nad Hashimi, who's a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver and the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. And in terms of the sites that the IAEA were denied entry a while back to a military site that's considered suspicious, any indications that they're going to be more forthcoming? What was behind the head of the IAEA's optimism?
Well, that's a good question. I think the only I think rational conclusion is that those controversial sites such as the Parchin site military complex outside of Tehran, and there's another one outside of the city of Qom, which have been off limits from an Iranian perspective. It seems now that Iran is open and willing to allow external scrutiny and observation of those sites. Had that not been the case, then Mr. Omano, the head of the IAEA, I think would not have made the statements that he did yesterday. So it remains to be seen exactly, you know, what the details are on that agreement. But I think the statements by the head of the IAEA suggest that there's been a shift and a willingness on the Iranian part to allow for greater international scrutiny and inspection of its nuclear sites. So that, I think, signifies a shift. And fundamentally, I think all of this is positive because it diminishes the possibility of a military strike and an ensuing war on the region, which would be catastrophic.
Well, most of the talk of military strikes have come from Israel. And, of course, recently President Obama said there's been far too much loose talk about war with Iran. And, of course, he's trying to dampen down the rise in the price of oil, which has, I think, accompanied much of these threats. But my understanding is that the Iranians don't necessarily take the threats that seriously. And I don't know whether the U.S. behind the scenes have given them the impression that they are not on board with these threats. What's your sense? I mean, we had the U.S. ambassador in Israel recently basically saying that the U.S. was all on board these Israeli plans to attack Israel. But, you know, that may have been for the domestic audience. What's your understanding about how credible and how seriously the Iranians take the Israeli threats?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think no one really knows because, you know, to answer that question, one would have to get into the minds and the inner circle of Iran's ruling oligarchy, which is a very small, narrow group of clerics centered around Iran's supreme leader. Officially, the position of the Iranian regime is that they don't take these threats seriously, that this is bravado, this is talk. I think what the Iranian regime does take much more seriously are the economic sanctions, which, if they continue, are going to seriously erode the viability of the Iranian economy and could seriously hurt the legitimacy and the stability of this regime, you know, looking forward months down the road, years down the road. So I think that's a much more significant factor. With respect to the, you know, the whole question of a military strike, there seems to be an emerging consensus, not only in the United States, but interestingly, even within Israel, there's a big division between the political leadership and the military and intelligence sort of leadership of the state of Israel, that latter group being strongly critical of the talk of war that is coming out of the mouths of Benjamin Netanyahu and his government. There's been a series of statements and an internal sort of debate suggesting that even within Israel, you know, people realize that the talk of a military strike on Iran and a possible war is catastrophic for Israel. So I think, you know, one has to also keep that in consideration. I think the Iranians are sort of, you know, they pick up on these debates and they are aware of it. To what extent they actually take these threats seriously remains to be seen.
So, Nader Hashemi, you mentioned that what is hurting Iran, or at least getting their attention, and perhaps has led to these talks, is the economic squeeze from the sanctions, and the second round of sanctions are apparently really going to bite, and that begins in July. But already there are reports that Iran's using surplus super tankers to store oil, which indicates that their oil is not being sold. What do you understand about the state of the oil market in Iran?
Well, I think it's very fragile. I think the Iranians are clearly worried that, you know, one of its major customers, in this case Europe, which purchases about, you know, 18 to 20% of Iran's oil as of July 1st, will no longer be an option for the Iranians, and that other countries in OPEC are going to be increasing production to fill that void. So I think, you know, the Iranian regime, despite its internal repression and brutality, is very sophisticated and realizing and being able to diagnose future threats and challenges down the road. And it sees that unless there is some sort of attempt at least to resolve the problem with the West over its nuclear program, that it could be in very serious economic straits, you know, a year from now. So I think there is deep fear and deep concern within the Iranian ruling elites and ruling circles over this question, and the best indication of that are the, you know, the talks that are taking place today in Baghdad and the tentative agreement that was reached with the IAEA just the other day. I mean, the question to ask is, what explains this shift? What explains the rhetoric coming out of Iran that, you know, there is a possibility of now resolving these questions? There's been a clear sort of shift, not a 180-degree shift, I would say perhaps, you know, a 45-degree shift in Iranian policy on this question. And I think that can only be explained by the existing sanctions that are in place and the threat of that might materialize in the coming weeks and months.
You just dropped out there. The threat of something that might materialize. If you could repeat that.
Yes. The threat of more punitive sanctions down the road in the coming months and years. I think that is also a factor that is affecting and shaping Iranian policy over this question. And I think that largely explains why Iran now is willing to negotiate, to present proposals, to entertain proposals, to allow for greater inspection of its nuclear program when, you know, just a month ago, it was not open to such possibilities. So I think the only explanation in the changing rhetoric and the changing attempt by the Iranian regime to try and reach some accommodation with the West is that the fact that its economy, if it continues down the current path, is headed for collapse, and the regime fundamentally wants to survive and wants to prevent that from happening. And so now we're seeing, you know, Iran coming to the bargaining table with an attempt to resolve this issue.
But Dada Hashemi, the other question that comes up, the one that needs to be answered, is why is this Iranian leadership putting this country through this pain? What is worth the sanctions that they've endured for a long time now, the isolation that they've endured? I know they blame the great Satan and the little Satan for everything, but it leads people, and at least in my case, to wonder what it is that's so valued about this nuclear program that they're willing to put themselves through all this pain. The idea of national pride is not sufficient an answer.
No, it's a very good question, and I think the answer to the question is that this is a regime that is fundamentally motivated by preserving its own existence and perpetuating its rule on power. In that sense, it's not different from other authoritarian regimes. Ideology matters much less than regime survival. And from the perspective of the regime, it feels itself very isolated and prone to possible future attack, thus necessitating the demand or the need for some sort of safety net, some sort of assurance that what happened to Saddam Hussein would not happen to Iran. What happened to Gaddafi would not happen to Iran. And in fact, about a year ago, a little over a year ago, Iran's supreme leader gave a famous speech right after the NATO bombing campaign began against Gaddafi in Libya, where the Iran's supreme leader explicitly said, now I'm paraphrasing, but it's pretty close to his original statement, where he basically said, you know, Gaddafi, you stupid idiot, look what you did, and look what you have, look at the problems that have now we'll look at the problems that you were facing because you gave up your nuclear program to the West in exchange for an economic relationship with the West and diplomatic relationship with the West, and now you are on the verge of being overthrown. And the point that the Supreme Leader was making is that we will not make the same mistake that Gaddafi made. In other words, the insistence and the stubbornness and the intransigence that the Iranian regime has shown on the nuclear question, I think, is motivated by the deep desire to develop nuclear technology and a capacity that it could then invoke if there was ever a crisis moment where it felt that it might be attacked or it might be the regime might be jeopardized, the survival of the regime might be jeopardized. And so to prevent, in other words, a repetition of events that we saw in Libya or in Saddam Hussein, that's really the motive behind this regime. First and foremost, and second, of course, Iran has aspirations to be a regional power, and it knows that if you join that special club, your regional clout enhances significantly. So I think those are the two motivating factors, and that explains why the regime is going to such extreme lengths to pursue this program. I think that's the explanation that most rationally makes sense to me.
Well, I understand that. You say the Ayatollah, the supreme leader, basically said that, you know, that Gaddafi's a fool and he shouldn't have given up his nuclear program. He lost his leverage, and implying that the Iranians would never do that. This regime would never do that. But on the other hand, the same supreme leader has recently said that nuclear weapons are a sin. Harum, I think it's the word.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, that's the official line of the regime, and I think my explanation for that is that the regime wants to have its cake and eat it too. In other words, it's pursuing a nuclear program that is very similar to what has been described as the Japanese option. In other words, Japan has the nuclear capacity and technology to produce a nuclear weapon if it desires, but it's not actually searching and engaged with the production of a nuclear weapon. So I think Iran wants to have the technology, wants to enrich uranium, wants to have the option, wants to become a nuclear capable state, but at the same time it doesn't want to produce a nuclear weapon at this moment. So this way the Ayatollah can sort of deflect criticism by saying that, you know, from the perspective of Islam's ethical and moral system, it is a sin, it is un-Islamic to obtain a nuclear weapon because these weapons are catastrophic and weapons of mass destruction. But at the same time, Iran wants to produce the capacity and to get that technological know-how. If ever, in a moment of crisis, it needs to produce a weapon, then it can quickly sort of shift gear and it can claim, well, look, the survival of our regime was at stake. We have to sort of, you know, go in this direction. And so I think that really explains the frequent invocation of the supreme leader that Iran doesn't want a nuclear weapon. And its claim that it's not pursuing a nuclear weapon is not sort of something that can be diminished to the Ayatollah himself. A lot of, you know, there's a consensus among senior military leaders in the United States that Iran is not actively trying to produce a weapon, but it's experimenting with technology that would give it the capability to produce a weapon in the future in a moment of crisis. So I think this is allows the Ayatollah to sort of have his cake and eat it too. There's also an added story. About a month and a half ago, there was a report that came out in the 1980s that Ayatollah Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic, decided to pursue research to produce a nuclear weapon. And this was the context of the Iran-Iraq War when Saddam Hussein was using chemical weapons, and it was decided that Iran needed to pursue a nuclear option. And the current supreme leader was there at that meeting and apparently also endorsed and signed off on this this project and on this new policy, thus undermining the claim that, you know, obtaining a nuclear weapon is Islamically unforbidden. I think, you know, let's remember that he is first and foremost, I think, a politician more than a religious leader. And so if the needs of state dictate that you need to pursue a nuclear weapon, then you will easily, you know, just shift policy and make a moral justification for why the old policy no longer stands up.
So, Joe, Nad Hashimi, again, the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. It would seem, though, that one would like to know what happened to the Green Movement. Obviously, they were brutally repressed by the Basij militia, which is religiously motivated but still a part of the Revolutionary Guard Corps. It's hard to think of an analogy here in the United States of young religious zealots. If Pat Robinson and Jerry Falwell had Christian vigilantes and armed them,
right?
I mean, it's hard to come up with a comparison. But the long and the short of it is, there is obviously support for this regime. And when we always assume that all the young Iranians are all pro the Green Movement and want to get rid of the Ayatollahs, that may be the case in the urban areas, but you know, not necessarily the case all across the country. So just give us a sense of what's smoldering, and you know, the embers smoldering under the ashes is the analogy that's been used.
Right.
And in the context of Iran having, you mentioned about their regional role, you know, they could have a big reversal by losing Syria, and then that would weaken Hezbollah. So there are some, you know, some reason to think that that the Green Movement could come back.
I mean, those are all really good questions. I mean, the status of Iran's opposition Green Movement now is that it is going through a very difficult phase of its existence. It's basically trying to survive. All of its senior sort of political intellectual leadership are either in jail, imprisoned, or in exile. There is an external division of this group that exists abroad. But one of the challenges that you indicated that faces Iran's pro-democracy Green Movement is that it's facing a regime that is very brutal, and this is a regime, as you indicated, that does have a base of support, and has a base of support that is not very wide, but it is in other words, sorry, it's a regime that has support that is not very deep, but it is wide. And what I mean by that is that this is a regime that has a group of ideologically zealous followers that believe that the supreme leader is God's representative on earth, and if he gives them command, they are willing to, you know, break a lot of heads and kill a lot of people. And one of the things that has struck me in terms of the recent events in the Arab Spring, one of the lessons to be learned is how all authoritarian regimes do have a certain base of support, and it's very difficult to overthrow an entrenched authoritarian regime simply by nonviolent protests. The lessons of Syria, in other words, here, I think, are instructive in terms of understanding the possibility of a democratic transition in Iran. What do you do when you have a regime that's willing to kill thousands, hundreds of thousands, perhaps more, to stay in power? And, you know, there is that element within Iran that believes that they have God on their side, and they're willing to shed a lot of blood to retain power. So I think these are sort of challenges that are facing the Green Movement. The Green Movement also has internal sort of ideological challenges in the sense that officially the leadership of the Green Movement is not in favor of revolution. It's in favor of a reform of the existing system. And that is a very controversial and divisive sort of question. But I think it's one that, you know, Iranian Green Movement supporters are going to have to work out among themselves. But I think the desire and the hunger, as you indicated, for political change in Iran is very deep, is very widespread. There's a long history of pro-democracy activism in Iran going back over 100 years. And unfortunately, this regime has been able to immunize itself somewhat from the domestic desire for political change by constantly playing up the possibility of an external Israeli or American military strike on its territory. The nuclear question feeds into the regime's strategy of survival. The nuclear question has been spun by the Iranian regime as a nationalist question. That immunizes and sort of gets the regime some support as well. And so there are huge obstacles that I think are facing democratic forces in Iran. I think if we can sort of somehow remove or resolve the nuclear question and remove the possibility of a nuclear strike on Iran, that will create, I think, a more healthy atmosphere that will allow for civil society to perhaps reconstitute itself and allow democratic forces to reconstitute itself. As we know from the Egyptian Revolution and the Tunisian Revolution, there's no predicting when a political change can happen. You know, I'm of the view that if one wants to watch for a particular moment of crisis, you know, the current supreme leader, who is all-powerful, is eventually going to pass away from the scene. When he does die, that will be a moment of huge decision-making and a huge crisis for the regime in terms of who will replace them, the possibility of an opening for democratic forces, but that we'll have to, you know, wait and to see, you know, what transpires on that front.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Nader Hashimi.
Glad to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nader Hashimi, who is a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Joseph Kobel School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and the co-editor of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, and The Struggle for Iran's Future. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the firing of the head of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Recommended that I stay indoors, because the air outside will make our cells divide at an alarming rate, until our shells simply cannot hold all our insides in, and that's when we'll explode.
The Adams here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military Adam, like who gets there firstest with the mostest Adams. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They got to get together or disintegrate. I hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me now is Arjun Makhijani, who is the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. He holds a PhD in engineering, specializing in nuclear fusion from the University of California at Berkeley, and has spent the last decades working to promote an economy based on completely renewable energy. His books include Nuclear Wastelands, Mending the Ozone Hole, and most recently, Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, a Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Arjun Makhijani.
Thank you, Ian.
And on Monday, the embattled chairman of the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Gregory Jasko, stepped down. The industry have been trying to fire him from the day one, since he got there 3 years ago. What was it about this fellow that they didn't like?
Well, Dr. Jasko is a regulator, you know, and there is a kind of a knee-jerk, anti-regulatory, ideological bent in much of industry here. Not all, but much. And I think actually the nuclear industry, like all other industries where you can have serious accidents and safety issues and public well-being issues, needs regulators, needs to ensure safety. Now, it's well known that I'm not a fan of nuclear energy, but I'm also a realist. I know we have 104 reactors, and that while they're operating, I really want them to be overseen carefully, and I particularly want people over there who are going to be awake to what we should be doing so we don't have an accident like Fukushima.
Well, apparently the two commissioners on the NRC, two Democrats and two Republicans, sent a letter to the White House last fall expressing grave concerns about Jasko's actions, which they say was causing serious damage. But his actions were in response to what happened at Fukushima. So what is it about, what are the other commissioners on the NRC, what are they complaining about in terms of Jasko's actions?
Well, I think their formal complaints were about personal manner and behavior and so on, and I'm not privy to that. All I know that Dr. Jasko was, and continues to be, because he's still in office until replaced, a good regulator. I don't agree with everything that he voted for, certainly, but I know that post-Fukushima, he appointed a team of senior staff people to give him a review. He made sure that they'd stay independent and that no one would interfere with them. They turned in a pretty good report. I didn't agree with everything in it. I especially didn't agree that there was something that shouldn't need to be there that weren't there. But what was there was sound and worth doing. Some of the other commissioners at least seem more reluctant to implement these things rapidly. They have given licenses to two new nuclear power plants, four reactors in all, in South Carolina and Georgia. And he dissented from both those decisions, not because he wouldn't approve new reactors, but he said we have to make sure that post-Fukushima changes are going to be made, and the right time to ensure that is when you give the license. And I think that was a very bold and courageous stand, and obviously, you know, the industry wants to press ahead regardless, and I think that's a very rash thing to do, even for them.
Well, apparently Jasko was the lone dissenting voice on the five-member NRC panel,
yes.
And he voted against, and recently he voted against the approval of the first nuclear power plant built in the U.S. in more than 30 years. That's the one down in Georgia,
right.
By the Southern Company. And it sounds like he was one of the only kind of advocates for the public. The other commissioners seemed to be pretty much in the industry's pocket.
Well, you know, I think he was an advocate for safety. It's not that he hasn't voted for nuclear licenses. He has, but I think in this particular post Fukushima situation, the reason for his dissent is very sound, to make sure that all the changes that are going to be needed in light of Fukushima are required at the time of licensing. Once you have, you know, a few billion dollars invested and you require, say, a seismic upgrade that's going to cost you a couple of billion dollars, it's much more difficult to order a company to go back and incur that kind of expense. And the political pressures are much, much greater. And we know seismic backfits can cost a great deal. They did in California, not far from where you are, at Diablo Canyon in the 1970s and 80s.
Well, we also have south of us San Onofre, which nobody quite knows what's happened there. They put in new generators, and apparently they stuck in more steam pipes than they'd originally had the design call for in order to increase the output. And then they have suffered serious vibrations and leakage of radioactive water, and they've shut them down. A lot of pressure to turn the thing back on again. They've had to fire up a couple of retired gas plants because of the summer demand. But the long and the short of it is, it doesn't sound like they know what they're doing down at San Onofre. They can't literally find an explanation for the rapid deterioration of these steam pipes.
Well, I think they're also, Dr. Yasko made a very sound statement early on where there were some noises and rumors that the company was about to restart the plant or part of the plant and so on. He issued a statement saying that we're going to get to the bottom of this and the plants will not be restarted till we get to the bottom of it. And I think that direction to San Onofre was very appropriate and healthy. And I'm very glad that Southern California Edison has to pay attention to that and can't restart until they do get to the bottom of it. Because, you know, steam generators are the piece of equipment that carry away the heat that is generated in the nuclear reaction. And a failure of that, of course, means you have to shut down the reactor in an emergency. And presumably you can do it, but then, you know, you're entering the zone where risks increase of accidents. And you don't want steam generators to fail on you catastrophically while you're operating.
Again, I'm speaking with Arshan Makajani, who's the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, and his latest book is Carbon-Free and Nuclear-Free, a Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. But, you know, Yasko has come under fire from Darrell Issa, who's the House chairman of a number of committees. He's kind of on this kind of jihad against the Democrats and looking for reasons to go after them. But he's also was apparently had Yasko in his sights, as of course did Senator James Imhoff of Oklahoma, the global warming denier. He was out to get him. So it looks like I don't know. In the case, do you think his stance on San Onofre put him in trouble?
I don't know. I have not heard that. I have not. I think actually, at least one of the Republican congressmen from Southern California have said that perhaps San Onofre ought not to operate beyond its license lifetime of 2022. I might be wrong about that, but I think, you know, we're a nonpartisan institute, and I think, you know, support for nuclear power is pretty bipartisan. Actually, Dr. Yasko was appointed by George W. Bush to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and he was promoted to, under President Obama to be chairman. Now,
recommended by Harry Reid, who he used to work for, right?
Right, right. Yeah. But President Obama's appointments to the commission have voted for these new reactors. So it's not, I don't think the voting pattern on the commission is partisan. I think there's a kind of an anti-regulatory idea. Perhaps, I think on that regard, certainly more on the Republican side than on the Democratic side, I think it'd be fair to say, although not totally. But I think this anti-regulatory idea that regulations are bad, oversight, that tough oversight is bad, actually, I think the period of tough oversight after 1979, after the Three Mile Island accident, is the foundation of the safety record of the U.S. industry. And I think laxness, you know, movement in the direction of being more lax in the last 15 years, in my opinion, is not a healthy thing for the industry. I would like to see nuclear power phased out, but I certainly want things to be safe. I share that goal with a lot of people who may support nuclear power. So I think Yasko was a very healthy thing for the nuclear industry, and I'm very sorry to see that he stepped down.
Well, just in closing, though, Arjun Makhachani, what the other commissioners are saying about him and what his critics are saying is that, and including Dale Klein, who's one of the Republican-appointed commissioners, he's saying that because Yasko was always, they've had so many 4-to-1 votes with Yasko voting against the four of them, that meant there was something wrong with his leadership. What I'm concerned about is that Yasko was the only guy there that was voting for safety and in the public interest.
Yeah, on technical things, you know, majority isn't always right. It's not also so that minority is right. You know, minority is not pure by the virtue of being a minority. You have to look at the merits of the situation. And on the merits of the situation, when Chairman Yasko dissented, as he did in the case of Vogtle, these new nuclear power plants in Georgia and South Carolina that have been authorized recently, I think he did so out of the kind of prudence we need from a good regulator. I think the same is true in relation to San Onofre. You don't want a utility that has been upbraided for not having adequate operations in its nuclear in the nuclear sphere in the past to be starting up a reactor that has serious problems in essential equipment without knowing what caused those problems, especially as the equipment is new, and you know, and the problems have occurred in both reactors, not just one.
Well, Arjun Makhachani, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you very much, Ian, for asking.
Again, I've been speaking with Arjun Makhachani, who is the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. He holds a PhD in engineering, specializing in nuclear fusion from the University of California at Berkeley, and he has spent the last decades working to promote an economy based on completely renewable energy. His books include Nuclear Wastelands, Mending the Ozone Hole, and most recently, Carbon-Free and Nuclear-Free, a Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Christina Trutanich. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.